Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. As Rida Chaitanya Prabhu announced this morning, we are resuming the topical classes, which will be held every Tuesday, like today. And Yadunandan Maharaj asked me to kick it off and get it going. And the topic is, these topical classes, as far as I've understood from Yadunandan Maharaj, and as far as I've understood from attending some of these, I've never actually given one, is to look into the principles of bhakti and the primary principles, the aspect, the elements of sadhana bhakti, as well as the secondary aspects of bhakti, the secondary principles of bhakti, things like the general values that we find in our scriptures. And Maharaj asked me to look at the relationship between these two, sort of as a general introduction to these topical classes. So that's what I'll try to do. And just to before we chant the verse you have up there, I'll just introduce it a little bit. And throughout our scriptures and in the writings of Srila Prabhupada and of our acharyas, we find the statement that bhakti is independent, devotional service is independent. Unlike other practices, unlike other religious paths, bhakti does not depend on anything else. If you want to do karma, if you want to follow the path of karma, and for example in the form of Vedic rituals, it depends on a lot of things. You have to perform the ritual at the right time, you have to have the right people involved, it has to be done in the right place, and it's dependent on so many other activities that lead to this one particular ritual act that you're performing. But our acharyas say that bhakti is not like this. Bhakti is independent. It does not depend on the qualification of anyone, in a sense. So anyone is open to it. Bhakti is open to everyone. Anyone can take to the process of bhakti. It is also not dependent on any other activity that you need to perform first in order to do bhakti. Like with the performance of a Vedic ritual, there's other things that you need to do before you can actually do the ritual. There's preparation that needs to be made. And our acharyas also say that bhakti is not even dependent on the proper execution of it. It's bhakti, the power of bhakti is such that even if you don't do it properly, it still has an effect. We have these statements in Shastra that even if you chant the name of Krishna in the improper mood, and you chant it jokingly or mockingly, then there will be an effect there. It may not be the full effect, but it still will accomplish something. If I perform a Vedic ritual and I do something wrong, then the whole ritual is spoiled. Second year students will have realized by now, I hope, that in the Vedic tradition, if you don't chant, they stress enormously that the preservation of the sound of the Vedas rather than the meaning of the Vedas, because if you don't chant the mantras properly at the sacrifice doesn't work. It has no effect. The ritual depends on the proper execution. And so our acharyas say, well, bhakti is not like this even. It is also not independent in the sense that it's not dependent on anything else. You cannot do anything to obtain bhakti in a way, because bhakti is transcendental. Bhakti is not something of this world. And anything we will try to do will be something of this world, and so we cannot obtain that which is transcendental. And Prabhupada and our acharyas explained that bhakti is actually the internal potency of the Lord, embodied in Srimati Radharani. Srimati Radharani is Krishna's internal potency. And so it is, in a way, it is non-different from Krishna, because Krishna is independent and not controlled by anything. Therefore, bhakti is independent and is not controlled by anything. And so one might wonder, well, if that's the case, how can we obtain bhakti? It is explained repeatedly that it is by grace. We can only obtain bhakti by the grace of the Lord and by the grace of a Vaishnava. And it's particularly by the grace of the Lord that comes in the form of the grace of a Vaishnava. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu teaches that Guru Krishna Prasade Pai Bhakti Lata Beach, that by the mercy of Guru and Krishna, we get the seed of devotion from which our creeper of devotion, our beautiful plant of devotion, can grow and ultimately flower and bear fruits. But it is dependent on that grace. It is dependent on the grace of the Lord. So the Lord can give bhakti to whoever he wants, and whatever their qualification in this world, he can decide, okay, this person is I'm going to give bhakti to. But it generally comes through the mercy of a Vaishnava, somebody who has bhakti. As Vishwanath Chakravarti likes to quote a verse from the Bhagavatam to make this point, where it says, bhaktya sanjataya bhaktya, that bhakti is born by bhakti. And so the Vaishnava has bhakti, and he can give bhakti to others. So bhakti is not born from anything else. It's not born from our perfect execution of dharma, of karma. It's not born from jnana, but it is only born from bhakti. And so we need the grace of that. And that is how we obtain bhakti. That's how we obtain the path of devotional service. But it goes beyond that, because then once you engage in bhakti, what does Krishna say happens? Is the mood one has, a devotee has, is that he follows the Krishna's final teachings in the Gita, sarva dharman parityaja. He gives up all dharmas. He gives up all these principles that we find repeatedly mentioned in scripture. So Krishna is telling Arjuna that you're thinking in terms of dharma. You're thinking, I will not fight in this war, because these people are my elders, and one principle of dharma is I should respect my elders. You're thinking ahimsa, non-violence, is a dharmic principle, so I will not fight because of this. And so all the reasons Arjuna gives in the first chapter are all very dharmic reasons. But Krishna says, no, give up all these dharmas. Don't consider these at this point. And mam ekam sharanam braja. Instead of seeking refuge in these various dharmas, instead of finding support in these various dharmas, find only support in me, Krishna says. Only come to me and only seek your refuge in me. I'm the only thing that consider myself to be the only thing that will sustain you in life. In case Arjuna was wondering, well, will that not lead to adharma? Will that not lead to bad reactions? And will I not be involved in sin because of that? Krishna assures him that moksha ishami, I will protect you from anything that might happen. And mashucha, do not fear. Do not worry about this. And so one might get the impression that bhakti is independent of any is independent of anything or of everything, and is the execution of bhakti, if we follow Krishna's words, is a rejection of all these dharmic principles. One might be a little confused, because our scriptures do talk about these principles at great length. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, he talks at great length about all these wonderful qualities like truthfulness, tolerance, non-violence, simplicity of mind, the sense control, mind control, renunciation, detachment, all these things he discusses at quite some length. If you read chapter 12, which deals directly with bhakti, has this long list of all these qualities that he says these are the qualities of a devotee. So how do we understand these? There seems to be a conflict there. On the one hand, we say, well, bhakti is not dependent on these and is sort of separate from all these. But on the other hand, we find in scripture that there's statements that these things seem to be important for bhakti. So how do we reconcile these two? And the The way we can reconcile this, the way we can understand this, the relationship between the two, is by looking at what does it mean to be a prapanna, to be somebody who has surrendered, to go for Sharanagati, to seek shelter only in the Lord. What does that mean? In his purport to that verse of the Gita, Prabhupada quotes this analysis of Sharanagati, of seeking shelter, of full surrender. And the first two principles of that are anukulyasya sankalpa, pratikulyasya varjanam, that the acceptance or the intention, the resolve to embrace that which is favorable, and the decision to reject things that are unfavorable for one's Sharanagati, for one's seeking refuge. Now, the things that are unfavorable, they're fairly easy to consider. If you engage in the process of bhakti, naturally you'll want to avoid the things that are opposed to bhakti. So Prabhupada would often say, if you're trying to light the fire, you're not going to pour a bucket of water over it, because that will counteract what you're trying to do. And so we abstain from sinful activities, from activities that are motivated by our own desires, by activities that that entrap us more in this world, and that direct our attention more to this world rather than to Krishna. And so we abstain from these, and that's why Prabhupada says the way he set it up at initiation, you take a vow to abstain from four things. You abstain from meat eating, and fish and eggs, and illicit sex, gambling, and intoxication. And Prabhupada explains these are the sinful activities that are like, you know, pouring a bucket of water on fire, and we're trying to light the fire. And so you abstain from these. So that is the rejection of those things that are not favorable. And that's fairly easy to comprehend. It's a little more tricky when it comes to the other side, the acceptance of things that are favorable. And we reject things that are unfavorable. And these happen to be the things that are considered to be adharma, non-dharmic things. So does it mean that our acceptance are things that are are things that are dharma? Does that mean that these are the things we accept? And so that's what I want to look at now. But just to give you a little hint to what's going to come. In a way, that is the case. So we reject adharma, and we seek the support of dharma to enable us to seek shelter. And Krishna himself says that. He says, "Yesham twantagatam papam," those whose papa, whose sinful actions, whose adharma has come to an end, has been terminated. And "Yesham twantagatam papam," "Jananam punya karmanam," and those who have obtained, who are pure in their actions, who are dharmic, you could say, in their behavior, te dvandva moha nirmukta, they become free from the dualities of this world, the dualities of hatred and desire, of man and woman, and all these of heat and cold and light and darkness, and all these dualities that we find in this world. What Krishna says in the previous verse, these are the dualities we're born in. And so, but Krishna says, those who are free from sinful activities, and those who have been purified by pure activities, by dharmic activities, they become free from the dualities of this world, from the bewilderment of the dualities of this world, and bhajante mam dridhavrata, and they're able to really seek shelter in me. They're able to worship me, not just worship me, but dridhavrata, with a firm vow, with a firm resolve. These principles, some of these principles, if used or applied properly, can help us to come to this level of seeking shelter in Krishna, worshipping Krishna with this firm vow. I wanted to read this verse, and I don't know if we should chant this or not. Should we? That's it, Prabhu, should we? Okay. This is a verse from the 17th chapter of the Bhagavatam, of the first canto of the Bhagavatam, which talks about Maharaj Parikshit's encounter with Kali, with the personification of this age. And just to give you a little background, Maharaj Parikshit he arrives in near the on the bank of the Saraswati, and he sees there that there's a cow and a bull and a person dressed up as a king, and the person dressed up as a king is Kali, and he has broken three legs of the bull, and he's harassing the cow. And as the story progresses, we understand that the bull is Dharma, and the cow is Mother Earth. And so Parikshit sees this happening, and he will intervene. And in this verse, he's addressing the bull, he's addressing Dharma, and it's describing and praising Dharma. So tapasya cham daya satyam iti padha krite krita adharmaṃshais trayo bhagna smaya sanga madaistava tapasya cham daya satyam iti padha krite krita adharmaṃshais trayo bhagna smaya sanga madaistava. Tapasyau chandaya satyam. Tapasya cham daya satyam iti padha krite krita adharmaṃshais trayo bhagna Vaishnavis. Shaucham daya satyam tapa austerity shaucham cleanliness daya mercy, satyam, truthfulness, iti, thus, pada, legs, krite, in the age of satya, krita, established, adharma, irreligiosity. Angshay, by the parts, traya, three combined, bhagna, broken, Smaya,
Smaya.
Pride. Sangha, too much association with women. Madai, intoxication. Tava, your. I'll just read the translation because the purport is quite long and we might not have much time left to say anything else. In the age of satya, in the age of truthfulness, your four legs, your meaning dharma, your four legs were established by the four principles of austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. But it appears that three of your legs are broken due to rampant irreligion in the form of pride, lust for women, and intoxication. So, in the age of satya, your four legs were established by the four principles of austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. But it appears that three of your legs are broken due to rampant irreligion in the form of pride, lust for women, and intoxication. From this chapter, Srila Prabhupada, later on in this chapter, gets the four regulative principles that we follow. No meat eating, no illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling. Because Maharaj Parikshit sees Kali present there and sees what he's doing to both Dharma and to the earth. And Maharaj Parikshit intervenes. And the Bhagavatam says that not only will he restore the legs of Dharma, but he also banishes Kali. And he says, Kali, you cannot stay in my kingdom. And he gives a long list of all the places where he cannot stay. Kali realizes that, well, this means that I have no abode. So this is impossible. You should allow me some place to live. And so finally, Parikshit says, you can stay in four places. You can stay where there's gambling, where there's meat eating, where there's intoxication, and where there's illicit sex. And so this is where Prabhupada gets the four regulative principles from. And of course, those four principles, they're related to these four legs of Dharma. Kali broke the three of the legs of Dharma and was willing to break the fourth leg of Dharma. And those four legs of Dharma are broken by these four things where Kali, in the end, is allowed to reside. And Prabhupada, actually, in his purports in this chapter, relates the four regulative principles in various ways to these four principles. But generally, it is, you have them here, tapa, austerity, relates to intoxication. That intoxication, mada, which is not just the intoxication of getting drunk and taking drugs, but it's also, as in this verse, intoxication, sort of being full of oneself, being illusioned, and that breaks tapas, that breaks austerity. Shaucham, cleanliness, is broken by illicit sex. Daya, compassion, is broken by, sometimes Prabhupada says, interestingly enough, it's broken by intoxication. One doesn't become compassionate or merciful when one is drunk, I suppose. But generally, Prabhupada understands it that daya, compassion, is broken by the slaughter of animals and the eating of animals. And finally, satyam, truthfulness, that is broken by gambling. Shri Shri Radha Gopinath, and they, so in other words, the four regulative principles and these four legs of Dharma go together. And it's important to keep in mind because in a sense we vow to abstain from these four places, these four things that are under Kali's dominion. But one can also look at it in a different way, is that implicitly we vow or we commit ourselves to actually upholding the legs of Dharma in our own life and providing the support for Dharma to exist in our own life through these things. And then it becomes a different thing. It's generally the regulative principle that's easiest to most people is gambling. And it's some people sometimes wonder, well, why is this a regulative principle? I mean, I'm really not tempted to go and gamble. And, you know, why do we do this? But if you ask yourself the other question is, well, I may abstain from gambling, but am I truthful? That becomes a bigger issue. I may abstain from eating meat, but am I compassionate? It's a bigger, it's a more encompassing thing to pursue. The eating of meat is one way in which I show my that I don't have compassion, but compassion extends to a lot more. So one has to ask himself and herself that, you know, to what extent am I following these principles to the fullest extent that I can. And Prabhupada, throughout his books, he talks about those four principles. And whenever he talks, or often when he mentions one of these principles, he says, this is the most important one. This is the foundation of everything. And so he talks about tapas. He says, there is no spiritual life without tapas. And he talks about cleanliness. And he says, cleanliness is the most important thing in spiritual life. And in this way, he talks about all four of them, and in a sense, this is very true, because Dharma is supported by all four of them. Dharma has four pillars or four legs, if you think of Dharma as the bull, and he's supported by all four of them. So all four of them are important. A one-legged bull cannot really, you know, run or walk, and a two-legged bull will have a very difficult time to run as well. And I can imagine even a three-legged bull will have difficulties moving around. So all four are important. But in a sense, here you find them in this particular order in this verse, and in other places they're given in different orders. The four legs of Dharma are again talked about in the third canto and again in the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam. And they're given in a different order, and sometimes a few of there's different terms used, but they all refer to the same thing. But I like to think of them in a particular order, actually. So what I want to do now is just look at all of them and see how they relate to Dharma and how they relate to Bhakti. And of course, part of the thing you have to keep in mind is, who is Dharma really? What is he representing? What is this the bull representing? Is he representing the Dharma that is related to the karma path, or is he the parodharma, the highest Dharma, the Dharma that the Bhagavatam just a little earlier declared to be savai pungsang parodharmo yato bhakti radhokshaje, that the highest Dharma, the most supreme Dharma is bhakti to Adhokshaje, is devotional service to the Supreme Lord. And so I want to look at the Dharma in those two ways. On the one hand, Dharma is just doing the things that Krishna says one should reject, that one should not depend on and see as ends in themselves, as Arjuna did in the beginning of the Gita. But on the other hand, Dharma is also bhakti. And so looking at how these two relate and how those four legs of Dharma relate to these two things. We'll start with Satya. Satya is truthfulness. It's the last leg that is still standing. And Prabhupada says this is the most important principle of religion. Later in the next verse, Maharaj Pariksit says, and I can see now that only truthfulness is standing. And Prabhupada says this is the foundation of spiritual life, of being religious, of being spiritual. And truthfulness, of course, means you can look at truthfulness in various ways. The sort of surface understanding of truthfulness means you tell the truth, you don't tell a lie. It means you are true to your word. If you promise something, you stick to your promise. And we find in the scriptures repeatedly stories of Brahmins who are truthful because they stick to their word no matter what. They made a promise, they made a vow, and they stick to that. And they're praised for being truthful, for being true to their word. But it's very difficult not to tell lies. We tell lies all the time, actually. Pascal, the French philosopher, he says that if friends would know what their friends say behind their back, there would be no friendship in this world. Because we all lie to each other. We all either in a sort of a stating the untruth, or by being economical with the truth. We don't say the whole truth, and we sort of withhold certain things that are really on our minds. And so Pascal, one might say he doesn't have a very optimistic view of humanity, but he says if friends were to know what other friends say behind their back, there would be no friendship, because people lie, and people are not truthful in their lives. But truthful, and so this is the dharmic understanding of truthfulness. If you've given your word, you stick to it. If you speak the truth. The Raghu dynasty, in which Lord Ramachandra is born, is praised as satyayamita bhashinam. Their words, their speech is measured for the truth, meaning they only speak in order to state the truth. And it's a great virtue. They measure their words. They're very careful with what they say because they only want to say the truth. And so it's a quality we can aspire to. And Prabhupada often talks about the importance of telling the truth, of being truthful, and particularly of being true to one's word. Prabhupada would often say, "You've taken vows. Now be true to those vows. You've promised before the fire, before Krishna, before the Guru, to uphold certain things. Now be truthful to that and stick to that. You've given your word, and that means something." But truthfulness goes beyond that, and Prabhupada actually more often explains truthfulness as being, in order to be truthful, you have to know the truth, obviously. And in order to, so in other words, truthfulness is not just honesty, is not just being honest, but is actually living according to the truth. And the truth is, of course, Krishna. Satyam Param Dhimahi, he's the supreme truth. And so Prabhupada often talks about truthfulness being recognizing the existence of God, recognizing the supremacy of Krishna, and living your life in accordance with that. Suddenly truthfulness is no longer just a principle, a sort of an ethical value, a moral that is good to uphold in this world, but is raised to the highest position. It's directly related to bhakti. And then you can understand why Prabhupada says that truthfulness is the foundation of spirituality. If you don't accept the existence of God, what spirituality can you have? If you don't think Krishna exists, then why are you worshipping him? And so this is the foundation. Satsarup Maharaj wrote a very nice book, actually, not very long, on truthfulness, the last leg of religion, where he looks at this in great depth and analyzes this at some length. And so this is the foundation. We need to be truthful. We need to recognize the truth. We need to recognize the fact that Krishna is the absolute truth, and that we have to respond to that and reciprocate with him in a particular way. And only when we do that can we be really truthful. Only when we do that we can really embody this first leg of dharma, the last leg that is still standing. And it's through the last leg, actually, this is the last one that is standing in the age of Kali. But through that, we can go to the others and try and restore the other legs. And so we go from satyam to tapas, to austerity. And austerity, again, Prabhupada repeatedly says, this is the most important part of spiritual life. There is no spiritual life without austerity. And generally we think of austerity as being doing something really tough, doing something really difficult. We speak, oh, this was a real austerity, Prabhu. This was very tough. I had a hard time doing this, but I persevered. But austerity is more than that. Austerity is, Prabhupada explains it in various ways. Prabhupada says it's to voluntarily take on something that's troublesome, but doing that for a particular purpose, to achieve something. It's the tapas is something that gives you a power, that gives you a strength. Tapas literally means heat, and so you build up a heat in your body, an energy that allows you to do certain things. Dhruva Maharaj performed tapas, and because of his severe tapas that he performed, he upset the whole world. The demigods in their abodes were disturbed by Dhruva Maharaj's tapas, because the heat, the energy he accumulated was so great that they could not stand it. And tapas in itself is, of course, not a good thing. Hiranyakashipu performed great tapas, but if you read in the Bhagavatam his words why he performs tapas, he says, "I will perform great tapas so I can have the position of Lord Brahma." That was his ambition, and of course this upset everything. And Hiranyakashipu is not someone, even though he's somebody who is very firm in his tapas, is not someone that we think of as one of our examples. It's not someone we try to emulate. And so tapas means giving up certain activities, not acting upon your desires. Karma tyagas tapo smriti, Krishna says in the 11th canto. Tapas is understood to be the karma tyaga, the renunciation of fruitive activities. We give this up, and this is tapas. So again, this, you can understand tapas on a dharmic level, as it's an important principle. We've seen when we talked about Vedic rituals, second years, how tapas is the state you develop while you're performing a Vedic ritual, and it's seen as something good for that. Tapas is what you generate when you're a brahmachari, and it gives you this power through the study of the Vedas, which allows you to perform sacrifices later on, and so on. But Prabhupada often talks about tapas not in this more material sense, but as a principle or an aspect of bhakti. And he talks about tapas as in two ways, actually. One, he says that bhakti, a devotional service, can only be performed when you give up the desire for sense enjoyment, and that is called tapas. So therefore, tapas is an aspect of bhakti, Prabhupada says. He makes this very, and the Bhagavatam actually makes this very clear, and Prabhupada makes it even clearer in the third canto, I forget now. After Brahma performs his austerities, his tapas, before creation, Brahma is born from the lotus, and he hears these two words, these two syllables, tapa, and he decides, okay, I have to perform tapas. And so he performs tapas, and the Lord is very pleased with him, and the Lord appears, and the Lord tells him tapo me hridayam sakshat, this tapas you have performed is directly my own heart. And Prabhupada explains, this means this tapas that Brahma performed is the Lord's internal potency. It is Krishna says, this is my own heart. And this means that the Prabhupada says, this is devotional service. And so tapas is not just something that you abstain from certain things, but becomes devotion itself if properly performed and properly understood. In the sense that you give up the desire for other enjoyments, for sensual enjoyments, for selfish enjoyments. But Prabhupada also hints at in his purport that tapas it can also be understood in a higher sense, in the sense that it's not just the rejection of something, but it's the acceptance of something as well. Prabhupada hints at in that purport, means to submit to a higher will. It means you restrain your activities, you restrain your will in order to fulfill the will of somebody else. And so tapas is, in that sense, bhakti. In bhakti, you say, as the poet, the English poet Tennyson says, our wills are ours to make them thine. We have a will. We have a will to do things. We have the capacity to act. But as Tennyson says, we have that capacity. We have our wills are ours to make them thine, to make them yours. And so we submit voluntarily. We say, I have a will, but my will be your will, or your will be my will, actually, more. And so I submit to that. I will be guided by, I will do what you, what pleases you, not what pleases me. And so then tapas becomes bhakti. Just like we saw truthfulness, when you understand truthfulness in a higher sense, it is the foundation of bhakti. And once you have truthfulness, then you submit to the will of Krishna and you perform tapas. And what happens then is you come to shaucham, you come to cleanliness. And cleanliness is again one that Prabhupada often says, this is the most important one. Prabhupada would often quote the popular saying that cleanliness is next to godliness. And Prabhupada wrote to Satsarup Maharaj, when Satsarup Maharaj was starting the Gurukul in Dallas, he says, I want you to be revolutionary clean. Revolutionary clean. So clean that it's revolutionary. And Prabhupada often emphasized cleanliness. And so he wanted his disciples to be clean, to bathe regularly, to have clean clothes, to live in a clean environment, that the temple is clean, that everything that is used in the worship is clean. And Prabhupada repeatedly insisted on this. This is very important. But cleanliness, of course, goes beyond just the cleanliness of the body. And Prabhupada, as often as Prabhupada emphasized cleanliness of the body, he emphasized cleanliness of within, the internal cleanliness. And so we have to clean our minds. Our minds are polluted by lust, anger, and greed. And so we have to remove those things. We have to cleanse our mind by these things. And that, of course, we know from scripture that we do through bhakti, that we do through devotional service. Prabhupada says, by chanting Hare Krishna, the mind becomes clean. Prabhupada would say that we are involved in brainwashing. Our brains, our minds are dirty, and they need to be washed. They need to be cleaned. And so we do this by engaging in devotional service. And so, in a sense, the cleanliness, you can again understand it in two ways. On the one hand, you have the cleanliness, sort of the external cleanliness, even you could say the internal cleanliness. But what's the point of being free from lust, greed, and anger if there's no devotion in your heart? And so the higher cleanliness, I mean, what does cleanliness mean? To clean something means to remove the dirt so that the true nature of the thing is visible. If I find a coin in the dirt, there's dirt, there's mud sticking on the coin. To clean the coin means I remove the dirt so that I can see the coin, and I can see, oh, it's a 50 euro cent coin or whatever. And so this is what it means to clean. So if we're cleaning ourselves, what does it really mean to be clean? It means that there's no no artificial imposition on ourselves. There's nothing that doesn't belong in our minds, in our lives, in our understanding, which means we are back in our constitutional position, in our natural position, which means we serve the Lord. And this is real cleanliness. We have this verse we often recite before yagyas. Apavitra pavitro va sarva vastam gatopi va. Whether one is pure externally, even internally, or impure, yasmaret pundarikaksham. When one remembers the lotus-eyed Lord, then one becomes entirely purified. Then one becomes really clean. And so tapa, by submitting to the will of the Lord, we become become clean, we become situated in our real position, and all these artificial impositions are removed, are gone. And finally we come to the last one, which is daya, compassion. And compassion is, as I mentioned, it's broken by the slaughter of animals. Meat eating is not a compassionate act. You cause harm to somebody else for your own satisfaction. And so it's actually something very, very cruel. And but what does compassion mean? What does mercy mean? It means you're unable to bear somebody else's suffering. You're unable to see somebody else suffer. And so we are compassionate in various ways. You can be compassionate by, if you see someone is hungry, you give them something to eat. You can be compassionate by just saying something nice to someone to lift their spirits and relieve their mental suffering. You can be compassionate if somebody is sick by tending to the sick and so on. And this is important, actually. Particularly for grihasthas, the Bhagavatam often stresses that the in the talking of the four legs of dharma in the third canto, daya, compassion, is changed to dhanam, to giving in charity, and they're placed in an order there where the four legs of religion correspond to the four ashramas, and so dhanam. Daya, compassion, in the form of charity, is seen as the main duty of the grihasthas, of those who are married, those who have families. There's a story of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who is once walking with some of his grihastha disciples somewhere, and they pass in India, and they pass some beggars, and you know all Bhaktisiddhanta just walked past them, but all his grihastha disciples walked past them too. And Bhaktisiddhanta turned to them and said, "Why don't you give to the beggar?" And they said, "Well, all our money belongs to Krishna, so we want to give to the temple." And Bhaktisiddhanta said, "If you don't give to him, you will not give to Krishna either. Because if you give to them, your heart will become softened. And this is a good thing. You're a grihastha. One of the duties of a grihastha is to support the society Prabhupada, when asked what is the duty of a grihastha, Prabhupada said, "You go outside and you shout before lunch, 'If anyone is hungry, please come.'" And that was Prabhupada's instructions for grihasthas. Compassion in the form of giving something to others is considered a good thing. But of course, Prabhupada explains too that compassion goes beyond that, because you may feed a person, but they'll still and relieve their hunger. You may cure somebody from disease, but they'll still die, and they'll still have to reborn, and they'll still suffer in this world. And so if compassion is being unable to see the suffering of somebody else, it means you do more than just feed them. You try to uplift them. And in the third canto, instead you try to uplift them. You try to give them something more. Prabhupada says in the Gita, ahimsa, non-violence, means not putting others in distress. And if you see people suffering in this world, if you have the understanding that this world is a temporary and miserable place, and you do not try to help people to get out of this world, you're actually being violent. So Prabhupada is not preaching, not telling others about Krishna, is actually being violent. One comes to the level of daya, the fourth leg of dharma, means one shouldn't just feed other people or cure other people, but most importantly, one should give other people the knowledge of Krishna. And if you then look at the four legs of dharma, you can see a progression. You start with the recognition of the existence of Krishna, satyam, that leads to tapas, that leads to the submission of your will to Krishna. You perform activities for the satisfaction of Krishna. This leads to shaucham, to an internal purity. The lust, the greed, and so on are removed, and your heart is cleansed by engaging in devotional service. And once that happens, the natural effect of that, the natural, if your heart is clean, what will happen is you preach, you tell others about Krishna. You have obtained a purity of vision, and so you feel compelled to help others attain that same purity, to help others live in truthfulness, to help others pursue tapas, and to help others become pure. So these four legs of dharma, we sometimes think of them as just principles that you can look at them in two ways. One is they're principles that support dharma, and dharma you can see as the paro dharma, the highest dharma. So truthfulness, austerity, cleanliness, and compassion, they support our life in devotion. They're things that are anukulya, that are favorable to our execution. They help us to direct our energies. It's basically, if you're not doing these things, what will you be doing? If you haven't attained pure love of God, chances are you will act in ways that are not conducive to pure love of God. So you restrict yourself in these activities. You try to be truthful. You try to be clean. You try to be compassionate. You try to be austere. And by doing that, you support your dharma. You support your bhakti. And by doing that, you come to understand that when Krishna says sarva dharman parityajat, give up all these things, it doesn't mean that Arjuna should lie and should be duplicitous and should be unclean and all these things. But it means that he does not seek support in this. They're not an end in themselves, but they're subsumed in bhakti. They're absorbed in bhakti and they become aspects of bhakti. And when they become aspects of bhakti, they strengthen bhakti. Bhaktiya sanjataya bhaktiya bhai bhakti, bhakti is born. And so one's bhakti increases by sticking to these principles if they're performed in a devotional way. You can look at, I looked at them from the top down, so you start with the preliminary one and you sort of go up, but of course they go the other way as well, that if you have this highest form of cleanliness or this highest form of compassion, they will manifest in the lower forms. If you're pure in heart, you will be externally pure as well. You live a pure life. You'll abstain from things that pollute you. You'll abstain from sense gratification. You live in a clean environment and so on. And so you can look at all these things like that as well. If you're really truthful to Krishna's existence, naturally you'll be truthful in your daily dealings as well. You won't have to hide anything from others. You won't have to be duplicitous about things. If you look at Prabhupada was sort of, he was truthful in the absolute sense, where he molded his life on the absolute truth. But he was also truthful in the other sense. Prabhupada was very direct, and there was no duplicity in his dealings with people. There was a straightforwardness that can only be obtained by truthful people. This is a way we can understand this. And the following weeks, every Tuesday, we'll look at a principle either of bhakti or of dharma or these supportive activities look at it closer. But I'll end here now. And there's what time are lectures supposed to end here? Is it 9 or 10 to 9 or 9:15 or? Okay. So is there a comment or? The third canto talks about them is that dhanam, which is daya there, is compassion. That's for the grihastas. Tapas is for the vanaprasthas. Satya is for the sannyasis, and which one is left? Shaucha, which the in the context there it said it is vidya, it is it is knowledge, and that's for the brahmacharis. And it says it is knowledge there because knowledge is the most purifying thing. Prabhupada says we clean the mind by having knowledge, by having the correct understanding. And so vidya or shaucha is for brahmacharis, I mean, it's not that the others don't engage in that, but this becomes most prominent in their lives. It's not that a householder is not clean or is not austere or is not truthful, but it means that their primary dharma on the level of the sort of the worldly dharma is in terms of giving. And of course, once there, if a householder is a devotee, then all these legs, all these principles are sort of supporting him or her. But for a worldly person, these are the most important things. But for a devotee, it's truthfulness in its highest sense, cleanliness in its highest sense, and so on are all present and all supporting their spiritual life, and are all part of bhakti. They're all part of that paro dharma, that highest dharma. Does that? Okay. Shall we enter? Shall we? Okay. So we'll end here. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.